Lectionary Lab Live is recorded in the studios of the 405 Oxford Group, Gainesville, Florida, and Brasstown, North Carolina, a Two Bubbas and a Bible production.
Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Man, good to hear from you today. We've had a variety of interesting mobile locations lately, and once again, you being the traveling man that you are, serving in many capacities, coming to us from the Lutheran Summer Youth Camp. Tell us a little bit.
I am in Rome, Georgia, at Berry College, and while my unit, we call it, are all in their small groups, I'm in an abandoned classroom down the hall recording from there. Great event. We have 200 or 300 every summer of youth from the basic four southeastern states, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, and Tennessee. And we gather all volunteer staff. Bishop's here as the chaplain, and we have great time. And things have been going well, as hot as it can be, and walking around and that sort of stuff. But buildings are air-conditioned. The worship's good. We've just had a great time. It's been a little sad this morning. The shooting in Charleston just happened, last night. And this morning began conversation. The Lutheran Seminary in the South is in Columbia, South Carolina, and the pastor of that was killed last night in that AME church in Charleston was a graduate of Southern Seminary, and there are people here who were classmates and friends. And so there's some soberness in the midst of our work. One of our texts says, "May our wailing or mourning be turned into joy," and so that's kind of where we are today, in portion today.
That's it.
Just aware.
That's it. Of course, we have no idea what's going to play out over the next few days, but as you say, we work several days ahead working on the show, and that grief is fresh for us today.
Right.
Truly, thoughts, prayers, and concerns with all involved. I have a good friend in Charleston, works at College of Charleston, texted this morning and said, my office is four blocks from the church, and so they're all feeling it today. Absolutely are. Well, the scripture speaks to us in the midst of life. That's one of the things that drives us here on the show. It's amazing. And as you say, we'll be working these texts today. These are the texts for the fifth Sunday after Pentecost, June the 28th, 2015. We'll not be dealing with Wisdom of Solomon text on the air today, but, we'll move from Lamentations to Psalm 30 to, the epistle in 2 Corinthians and the gospel text today, a text that has something to say about Jesus and illness and sickness and even the pall of death hanging around. So always amazing to me. Scripture has something to say to us where we are in life. What are you thinking this week about preaching, Bubba?
Well, there are three basic themes I saw in today's text. One is that of healing and resurrection. That's fairly obvious from the gospel lesson. It shows up in the others, and I'll mention that as we go along. There's some issues of inclusivity that I'll talk about as to how the lesson and gospel lesson plays out and who's involved. And then, obviously from the Corinthians text, there's the generosity, issue that we need to talk about a little bit, and what spurs our generosity, and from what place do we give? So those are some themes we can work with today.
Or to be able to find something there.
Yeah.
Let's jump in with the Lamentations text.
Well, one of verse 23 has, the line that spurred one of my favorite hymns.
Mm-hmm.
Great is thy faithfulness. And, I love that. So, Lamentations is some of the best information we have about the fall of Jerusalem as they were taken into Babylon. And it's, once again, you have this balancing of how could God let this happen to us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so this, the Lamentations, you know, lament has two things going on with it. One is that it says God is just. You know, there is justice in what has happened to us. God has judged us rightly, but judgment's not the end of the story. And that's where you get to the end of the, though he causes grief, he will have compassion. Verse 32. Right. For he does not willingly afflict or grieve anyone. 33. And so there's this dynamic going on that God will redeem. The steadfast love of God never ceases, but that doesn't mean it's all, a bed of roses for the rest of your life. If God loves you, it doesn't work out that way. Right. Sometimes things come and go, and God's judgment is just, but God has not abandoned us. And it's living in this, I think, kind of paradox between those two experiences, mm-hmm. and holding faith in the midst of things we don't understand as we're working through that.
Yeah. We often use the word tension in yeah. the text, and that arises from the tensions we experience in life, the paradoxes right. that, yeah. that face us. And so to understand that God certainly causes, allows, realizes that we endure grief, is balanced by that opening statement. The steadfast love of the Lord, there's never a time that it ceases. There is no end to God's mercies.
Right.
And so that's the baseline, I suppose. That's the foundational truth that we have here.
There's also a middle section in here that's kind of interesting, 25 through 30, that kind of examines the educational, I would call it formational value of struggle and difficulty, either for a nation or for individuals. It's good that one should wait quietly for the salvation. Good to bear the yoke in youth. You know, I'm here with all these youth, you know, thinking about bear the yoke, but it is, you know, occasionally somebody says, well, you know, he goes through a few things, he'll be a better pastor.
Right.
You know, or he, you know, you gotta learn, or, you know, these people want to think things are handed to them. They got to learn how difficult life is. I think that's the tonality here. And this verse, to sit alone in silence when the Lord has imposed it. Now, mm-hmm. Some of us have trouble with the idea that God might do something negative to us, because I think partially as Americans, we just assume we're supposed to be able to pursue happiness, and anything that doesn't make us happy is not okay.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's, what someone I was reading called the Americanization of Christianity at times, mm-hmm. that we need to examine that, not to say that, you know, God is making people die or making us sick or that sort of thing. But if we have a dynamic relationship with God, and God is active in our life, we have to look at that which we go through and say, God's active in the middle of this, and I'm learning from it, and I'm growing spiritually from it. And rather than always being, if I didn't like it, it was bad, and if I do like it, it's good, that doesn't necessarily mm-hmm. work out that way.
Yeah. We're fresh from the consideration of Job's story last yep. week in the yep. scriptures, and so this Lamentations passage makes a really good follow-up piece. That's exactly it. Stuff happens, y'all. Yep. Stuff yep. happens. We are living in a sinful and fallen world, and stuff happens. It's not always a direct correlation between the judgment of God, or you did something bad, so now bad things are happening, or that every bad thing in our life is irredeemable. I think right. that's where I see God at work in the midst.
Right.
Not so much that God is slinging bad stuff at us or causing everything to happen, but God is at work in the midst of that. It is not irredeemable. And
right.
again, that's because of this steadfast love and mercy, which this passage in Lamentations begins with. Well, Psalm 30 extends the metaphor a little bit, if you will.
Right.
I'm going to praise God because God has drawn me up. God yep. has cared for me. And in the midst of trouble, God has not allowed those troubles to triumph.
Yep. And, you know, the verse 5 kind of ties back to Lamentations very well. God's wrath is short. God's favor lasts a lifetime. Weeping spends the night, but joy comes in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to hear. Fresh for some people here. I did not know the young man we talked about who was the pastor of the church there in Charleston, but some people do. That mine is more of a a cultural grief today. Mm-hmm. Some of theirs is very personal, but, and you don't want to rush through it, but there is the confidence that God will be there for us on the other side, and particularly tied to the gospel lessons, which are about healings and restoration to life. You have some interesting verses here that go with that. Verses 1, 2, and 3. You've lifted me up. You've restored me to health. You brought me up, O Lord, from the dead. You restored my life as I was going down to the grave. So you can, for preaching purposes, you can use that within if you're preaching on the gospel, you could use that as kind of illustrative material, or you might preach there and say, what does it mean to say, have this kind of confidence in the face of death?
Absolutely. And I'm not sure we can make Psalm 30 purely a resurrection text,
no.
But this whole idea that God brings up, God raises us up. Again, I guess the motif I'm following, is there any moment in life, is there any person, is there any situation which is truly hopeless, truly irredeemable? And I guess my faith has to say no.
If you and if you expand the notion of resurrection from, and I don't want to say just, but merely or only, you know, the resurrection of a physical body from death,
right,
and to the spiritual, but resurrection as turning around that which looks hopeless into new life.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of resurrections, and I see it as that kind of text, because if only thing we're thinking about is when I die, what happens to me, and see that being with God forever, if that's the only thing we're labeled a resurrection, we have just closed the door on a huge section of what it means to be Christian and be Christian community. God's work is with the community, with the world. God is creating a new world and a new us in the midst of that. And part of the resurrection, this, that things look bad now, but could be, God is going to make things wonderful, is this eternal hope of God is still in control no matter what today looks like.
I'm with you on that. I think if we're waiting for, quote, the resurrection, and it's all about one event somewhere there at the end of my life, and until then, I'm just kind of getting along. No, that's not it. I think that's what makes verse 11 in this psalm so tangible and exciting to me. This is a vivid picture of resurrection. You turned my mourning into dancing. Now, see, that's transformation. That's the bringing of new life.
Right.
And I agree. We are a resurrection people. When we say that, that doesn't mean we're just waiting to one day for something to happen. We experience resurrections every day. Back to the Lamentations text.
Right.
God's faithfulness is new every morning. Every morning in the world, God's faithfulness is reborn, if you will. It's resurrected. It is making our lives new. So that's a good point. Let's don't choke off so much of the experience of being a Christian, living in community, living as resurrection people by thinking it is only about one event way on down the line somewhere.
Yeah, and as one of my professors like to put it, it starts now and continues through death.
It's a continuous action.
It doesn't start at death.
We are being saved, and you might as well say we are being resurrected.
Right.
Yeah, it is alive and active in us now. Okay. Well, I always think of you, Bubba, when I come to this text in Corinthians. Now, as you excel in everything, faith, speech,
that's
knowledge.
Sweet. If y'all believe that, he's got a bridge in Brooklyn.
There you go. Come see
that's
me.
Right.
Yeah, let's talk about this section of the letter. In some ways, a little bit different tone maybe from these other passages, but what do we got going on?
This is Paul as practical theologian, you know, as opposed to theoretical theologian. This is Paul as a mission executive, you know, if you're associational missionary, Lutheran, probably not the bishop, probably the assistant to the bishop. He gets to write the y'all pony up now letter.
Yeah,
you know,
that's it.
Right?
And Paul, Paul's a great fundraiser here. I mean, he starts out with you guys, you're so good. Your faith, your speech, your knowledge. You're so eager. Your love abounds. I know you'll do great with this offering.
This is the original of, you know, bread for the world or disaster relief. I mean, this is what it's about.
Yeah.
And he's organized, as you know, an offering for the folks back in Jerusalem who are suffering through drought and famine. And he's raising an offering, and he hits the right notes. He does two basic notes that are part of any stewardship thing. One is Christ has been generous to us. Mm-hmm. Therefore we are generous to others. You know, the generous act of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. This is the divine exchange on the cross. You know, he took on our sin, gave us his life. He takes on our poverty, gives us his richness. There's that image, you know, what Christ did on the cross in exchange. And then I don't think he's playing with guilt, but he is playing with an awareness that therefore, because Christ has done this for us, therefore we are called to be generous to others. And then he gets practical. He said, now y'all made a pledge last year,
which was good. You did a good thing.
Good pledge, but you gotta pay it up. You know, you gotta pay it up. You had eagerness. How many times have we had somebody make a pledge and man, they were eager.
That's it.
And then I come and I say, Pastor, you know, the boater died, and you know, I gotta have, cause my wife, she's sick and she needs to be out on that lake. I mean, I'm just joking,
right?
But you know, eagerly pledge and really intend it. And he says, you know, you were eager. Now let's follow through, complete it according to your means. Right. And then he says, now I know it, he said, I want you to be fair. It's not about your giving up stuff that you have to have and for people who, you know, don't really need it. They don't have anything, and you have abundance, because one of these days they might have abundance and you might be in need. Mm-hmm. And I never will forget a sermon by one of my classmates in seminary. He invited me to this revival meeting, Pastor Larry Blackwell. And it's been almost 40 years, and he was on Joseph and his brothers, and his sermon title and his refrain, I'll never forget, you better watch out how you treat your brother.
Mm-hmm.
You might need him on down the road.
There you go. That will preach.
Yeah, that will preach. Watch out how you treat your brother. You might need him on down the road. That's the point Paul is making here. And it's pretty straightforward stuff.
And a beautiful balance. And some of us may want to hold on to this passage until, you know, fall and stewardship campaign and et cetera. But it is laid out so well. It's beautiful. But it is not necessarily easy to preach, particularly, I'm going to come back to our contemporary American culture.
Right.
Certainly, this idea of a fair balance between your present abundance and another's need, that's a harder sell than it ought to be in our time.
We have a hard time believing that we have an abundance.
Right.
And sometimes you really have to start saying, look, let me explain the world situation to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because we live in a culture which has taught us that we need. That's what it's based on. We're
driven,
a consumer society, consumer driven. So for everything to keep working, we have to think we have to have this other stuff. We have to make this money. We have to spend this money. I was always interested after 9/11 that one of the things you could do to support, be a real American, was spend money and
absolutely
buy stuff.
Oh,
keep
yeah,
the economy going. That was pushed as a patriotic duty. And you know, it's interesting. I don't know anybody know cards and letters about me being unpatriotic. I'm not. I'm very patriotic.
We spend our fair share, don't we, Bubba?
We spend our fair share. Mm-hmm. But we do need to examine ourselves and say, how much of what I have do I really need? What is my abundance? And what is the need of the world?
Yes.
And how do I respond to it? Why has God called me to respond to that abundance? That need and my own abundance.
What is there about matching any abundance I may have with the need of another I may encounter? Not because I'm compelled to do so, not because the government regulates it, not because, you know, the preacher tells me or anything else. It is humanity and dignity at its root. I'm careful. I realize how many times if I'm not careful, I'll rub a little, you know, a little dab of church talk on it. I started to say, as God intended, but there is something here about the wholeness that God intends and the image of God in us. And I have a way that I need to respond when I say,
well, a couple of things I wanted to say about it as preachers, as preachers, there's one advantage about this text is you can say, I didn't pick it. In terms of waiting. You just say it came up today.
Right.
And the other one though is that we have to be careful, here to make it a because therefore, not an if then. Cause too often stewardship and that kind of preaching becomes an if then, you know, you're supposed to, you know, a law, supposed to give a tithe, you're supposed to do this, you're supposed to do that, da, 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 and it's kind of a guilt and people react. I don't think, you know, when they're always talking about money, I don't think we talk about money as much as they say we do. I think most people don't like to hear about it, so it feels like it's a lot more. But I do be aware that people are getting defensive when you start talking about their stuff, and it's really hard to have a time in which you talk about they have an abundance. And so working with this is a piece of walking a fine line through here.
Yeah. One of my favorite moments in pastoral and stewardship history was my church there in Nashville. You know them well.
The
outstanding Brook Hollow Baptist Church.
I love them.
And I do too. And anyhow, working with the finance committee, and so we had a stewardship emphasis, and I said, okay. And they said, well, you need to preach a sermon. Okay, I will. So I preached a sermon. It's not about the money. You know, that's fine. Kind of disarm everybody. Talk about, you know, life and time and talents and money too. Well, finance committee meeting the next month. Fine gentleman in the church sitting there, and we were evaluating the campaign. He said, well, that was pretty good, preacher. I really liked that. But to tell you the truth, I think we need to hear another sermon. It is about the money. Only time I've ever been encouraged to preach on the money.
Well, I've started a few once in a while. So every once in a while, we'll say it's not about the money. And every one of you goes, yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
So let me tell you.
We know.
Let me tell you. At least half of it, it's about the money.
It's about the money. Let's just get that out of the way.
But what does the money represent?
Right, right.
And what's underneath
that? That's the deeper issue.
Yeah.
Well, Bubba, we've got enough time to move to the gospel now. I'm so captivated by this double story, or literally a story within a story. Let's just start talking about it, because man, oh man, is there a lot of good stuff here.
Well, you know, as you say, there are two healings, and it's a typical pattern that Mark uses in which he fits one story inside of another story. You can just walk through Mark, and you know, you can read the whole book of Mark in 30 minutes. And I would suggest just walking through and seeing how many times he does this. Now, there are a couple of reasons for it. One's a storyteller technique, you know, to build suspense and that sort of thing. But I think the way Mark uses it, particularly today, is he has one story complement and comment upon the other. And you have patterns. You've got healings. You've got 12 years and 12-year-old, 12 years hemorrhage. You just got some things to sort. I can't unpack all of them. You know, I wouldn't do that. You need, as the preacher, you start saying, oh, look how this works. And look how that's what Mark is sometimes, thought of as the simple writer. And he's simple like Ernest Hemingway was something. Yeah, I mean, he's spare.
Every word counts.
Every word counts. He's not florid. And he uses a somewhat limited vocabulary to build tight little stories that come to the point. So first of all, just start with that first line. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, and you'll notice he goes back and forth on the lake and more. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's going on is there's the Gentile side and the Jewish side.
Right.
This is the inclusivity I was talking about. How this symbolizes for Mark's early readers that Jesus was tying the two communities together. They were separate, and he kept going back and forth between them. He was being a bridge, but not exactly, you know, I don't know what, he hadn't built a bridge, but you get the point.
Right.
He went in the boat back and forth. So now he's on the Jewish side. So he's got the ruler of the synagogue and a woman who was taken. One of the things I really love about the story about this woman is it's so up to date when she said she had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had.
Yeah, there you go.
She was no better, but rather grew worse. Boy, who doesn't know that story? You know, your HMO, your insurance isn't going to pay anymore. You've been to all these doctors and they just say, we don't know what's going on with you.
Mm-hmm.
We can't fix it. So I think that's an entree point for me.
Right.
In preaching this story, particularly I own it in my congregation where I'm 61. And if my wife's not there, the acolytes are the only people younger than me. They came with their grandson. It's not quite that bad, but you know, almost. Yeah. I'm in the youngest 10%, shall we say.
They love having a young pastor.
Yeah, it's the mountains. I'm up in the mountains and retirement mostly and that sort of thing. It's just the way it is. But so many people that aren't the age of my people have constant medical issues.
Right.
And so they will identify with this and the frustration and the fear. What the key in here for me is the contrast of fear and faith. He says, who touched my clothes? Who touched me? Woman, she came in fear, your faith.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with Jairus about his fear and his faith. And those two complement off of one another. And one of the interesting questions that people say is, how could Jesus let himself be delayed?
Right.
This woman's dying. This girl's dying. That woman's been sick for 12 years.
She'll wait.
She'll wait, but he stops. Some people spiritualize that Jesus was letting her die. The girl died so that he could do a resurrection. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jesus took things as they came. It's an interesting way this falls out. Those are just some of the thoughts that I've been having about this. There's the laying hand, the Jesus laying hands on the girl. That's what he asked for. Then the woman lays hands on Jesus,
mm-hmm.
which is a kind of interesting dynamic, that issue of touch and connection. And is Jesus like a talisman? You know, a crystal?
Right.
Or what really went on there? I mean, those are some...
Yeah. Well, and I think that's it. We see it right here in the interplay in these two stories. And certainly as you continue to read throughout the gospel, it disavows us of any illusion that there's only one certain way for God to work.
Yep.
That we must follow this plan, or it must be said according to this formula, or you must follow exactly this procedure. No. We have the story later where the fellow says, Lord, you don't even have to come. Just say the word. So we know that Jesus can heal long distance. We know that he can come and lay on hands. We know that he can be touched. Who had the purpose to heal when the woman touches him? Jesus doesn't have any purpose at all in that. It's her purpose. So I guess I take all of that to say, you know, let's be careful when we say, oh, this is the only way God can
heal. Right.
No.
I think if I will be preaching on this, and I think the direction I feel myself going is more along a mysterious. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes we think we've got to say, now this is what this means and this is what you have to do. And I, you know, what difference does it make? But I think the meaning here in staying with where we are in Mark and it's early in Pentecost, and I preach from I'm going to preach to these people all for years, you know, mm-hmm. perspective, not have to give all answers now to talk about who mm-hmm. is this Jesus and this mystery of trying to figure out he brings life. He brings healing. There's touch. And where does this come? And then he says, don't tell anybody. Help them to give her something to eat and to explore. What is it? You know, if we think we have all the answers, we're just really getting into the questions of, What I think the what difference does it make is that we are called to live in open-minded, continual relationship with this Jesus.
Yeah.
As we explore deeper what he means for us and explore deeper what it means to touch others in his name.
Yeah, yeah. God's mercies never come to an end. They're new every morning, new and different. the kind of wonder that says, I wonder what Jesus is going to do today.
Pretty much.
Yeah, that's it. All right, Bubba, we're about to run out of time. Good stuff. I appreciate it. I hope y'all finish up camp well. And again, our thoughts, prayers, and best wishes with everybody that's going to be studying, preaching, and teaching in these coming days. Not much left for us to do, Bubba, other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Mama Told Me by Frank Anea. We go out this session with Beethoven's Symphony No. 7 in A Major, Opus 92, from the album Classical Kids.